enough of that jazz. And his showbiz over all us. It's going on and on. Gee whiz, what is this? This is Wednesday, isn't it? Yeah, showbiz night. This is a good night for showbiz. This is a matinee day, and it's all around you. You get here in New York City, and you can just feel the showbiz days vibrating. Thousands of little ladies in shrapts eating those tuna salad sandwiches after their dose of Edward Albee. Somehow, a wonderful little ambience there exists, and you can see the happy, silly looks on the faces of the people who spent all afternoon in Fantasyville and some musical, you know, walking around and yelling and hollering somebody's stolen their left rear tire off from the parking lot and all that. You come back out here in real life, you can't tell which is which, though, really. But Fantasyville and the showbiz is all around. And to those of you who live outside of New York, you probably are not as aware of the tremendous amount of pressure showbiz has on the lives of the people who live here in the city. I'm sure that guys in Trenton do not have 17 consecutive pages of Earl Wilson, which some newspapers have given up news entirely. Now they only print handouts about what Julie Newmar is doing. By the way, what is Julie Newmar anyway? What does she do anyway? Her picture's always in. Have you ever tried to figure out what Jane Mansfield does? That's not easy in this day and age. You just guess, the big star, you know. It's a big visiting star. The showbiz atmosphere, though, here in New York sometimes is so cloying it makes your teeth itch. And to those of you who live outside of the city, you might not really feel it as much, but I really believe that what is in New York now will be the way the rest of the country will be in a very short time. In short, Cleveland is more showbiz today than it used to be. And New York is 17 laps ahead of the field and still going away, you know, still galloping strongly. The Mets are signing every day, speaking of showbiz. Wouldn't it be great if we got another ball team in town, though? I don't think a ball team would make it, though, here in New York. Look what's happening to the Yankees. You know, it's all showbiz in the yard wide, and it's kind of fun. When you look at where showbiz is going, though, it's got all kinds of areas that are not even tapped yet. For example, I have an ad here. You probably, from time to time, have gone past the toy stores, and you see in the toy stores now that you can buy costumes for kids, you know, like you can buy a fatigue suit. That kind of got me there. Down at the dime store, they have a fatigue suit with gravy stains on the vest. You know, on the blouse up there, on the whole business with a number on the back. I wonder if you can get a prisoner of war suit, PW, on the back. Or, you know, have you ever seen, have you ever been in the Army? You know, there's one costume you never hardly ever see in any of the movies about the Army. You never see it in the TV series about the movies, and that's the dark blue fatigues. And on the back, they just have a great big white P painted. Have you ever seen that? Now, that's not a PW. Don't immediately think that's ripped, torn, captured by the Japs. If they had that P, it would be just ripped, torn, captured by the MPs. That's, you know, under a pool table in the idle hour pool room after he's been AWOL for 3 days. And that's all. They just give you this thing. And I remember one of the first times I ever saw that. I'm in the IR. I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but this is the sudden realization that people ain't kidding around. Have you ever had that feeling that life is not always kidding around? You know, just when you fail sometimes in this life, and it's for real. And I'm in the Army about 3 days, and I'm going down past the service club, and I see this truck up ahead of me, and it stopped. And it rattles to the stop and pulls over, and I see a couple of guys jump down off the truck. And the truck is piled high with garbage, just as high as the sky, it's garbage. And these two guys jump down out of the garbage truck, and they're smelling to high heaven. And they both have dark blue fatigues. Now, everybody in our outfit wore green fatigues. These guys had dark blue denim fatigues. And they jumped down, and I saw two other guys jump down after them. But these guys were wearing helmets. They had helmets and field jackets and the whole bit, and high leggings. And I saw they were carrying something, and I didn't pay much attention. I thought they had dust mops, you know, or brooms, or maybe handy pantry butlers or something, and I'm walking along past this thing, and I hear a little muffled cursing, And I see these two guys in the dark blue fatigues very silently. They are loading garbage cans into the truck. And I notice that they have their monograms on their back. And strangely enough, both their initials were P. Big white P's painted all over the back, and these two guys stood next to them with sawed-off shotguns and just watched them. And it didn't look like See Here, Private Hargrove. I mean, it just didn't look... You know, speaking of Fantasyville, I wonder how many of you... It's just a question. I wonder how many of you saw a movie, a late movie, on television. I don't know whether it was last night or the night before, but it just seems sometime this week, where Preston Foster and Slim Somerville and Arthur Treacher were prisoners in the doggondest jail you ever saw in your life. Did you see that movie? Unbelievable jail. And you know how they always used to talk about Hollywood as the dream factory? Only once in a great while can you really see a dream factory at work. And here these guys were in the slammer. They were in a big slam, too. It was the big house. They were in something like Leavenworth. And all they did in jail was rehearse for the show. Somehow I had the feeling I was looking at Middleton College, that college, you know, that Betty Grable always went to, that Betty Grable and Jack Oakey and Tom Brown were always going to, Middleton College, you remember that one. She was always standing up on the library table saying, "And now let's all give a big cheer for the Middleton team. We're going to win next week against Circle U. We're going to win. Hooray!" You remember that scene all the time? And it was doubtful whether Tom was going to graduate because that rotten old professor played by Lewis Stone was threatening to flunk him for math. And he did flunk him. And just before the big game, he relented. And they had to rush him into the stadium at the last minute. Well, they did that, believe it or not. It was the only time I have ever seen a slammer, a prison movie, that the basic thing in the prison movie was the prison football game. And believe it or not, did you see that plot? Any of you see that? It was an unbelievable movie. These two guys busted out. Of course, you can't imagine Preston Foster as a prisoner. Oh, you never saw such a happier bunch of prisoners. They're in this room. They sleep four in a room. And you never saw anything. Oh, it was just all clean. Oh, no, this was all good, clean, wonderful fun. And they were always singing and practicing and tap dancing. I never saw a slam like that where the guys were all tap dancing and singing and practicing for the big game. For the big game, which they were going to have against another state pen. The big game of the year. And the night of the big game, when they were having their big show, Preston Foster and his buddy, can you imagine Arthur Treacher as an ace halfback? Well, Preston Foster and Arthur Treacher busted out of the slam, and they were the star football players. Well, the whole crux of the plot was to get them back into the slam in time to score the winning touchdown. Well, I want you to guess whether or not they did. You know, I didn't know whether I was supposed to applaud them going back to jail or not. You know, it was showbiz, and of course, all the way a yard wide. Now, showbiz, of course, is getting far subtler these days. In those days, it was very obvious. That was a showbiz jail, and it was quite obvious. But here, for example, you've probably gone past stores, toy stores, and you've seen these costumes for kids, cowboy suits, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Soldier suits, now you can buy little general costumes. They don't have enlisted men suits anymore. I noticed that, especially at FAO Schwartz. You don't buy a corporal suit. You buy a lieutenant commander suit in the reserve, by the way. The kid, so you can see he's in the reserve. He's got the little thing on the side. And yeah, you can also get yourself a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And he's an academy man. You can see he's an Air Force academy man. You can also get yourself a little plebe suit. But now I see, this is kind of nice, you get a little nun habit now. I'm not making it up. I can see a little kid out there playing in her nun habit. I know. You can get a little nun and a little priest. I kind of like that. I suppose since this is quite up, you can probably get a little rabbi suit, too. And no doubt you can get a little Norman Vincent Peale suit, too. Somewhere, a little Billy Graham suit. Bring me some more showbiz music on there, if you will, please. Yes, what is the role that you're playing in, my friends? Are you a poor, sad, little, creature blown by the winds of fate and chance? As you sit there in the sales department with the sound of the water cooler guggling and gurgling behind you, and you have a good half hour till coffee break, weeping inside, wailing inside, tears of remorse, how have I wasted my life? What have I done? Poor little match girl. poor little blown newsboy of the sales department. Oh, yes. Well, then on the other hand, do you see yourself as a kind of Tony Martin of life? Eh? Do you? With a big, fat, gommy smile on your face, getting ready to sing songs for the moon? Huh? Wavy hair and a square jaw? A sort of Nelson Eddy of existence? Or do you, on the other hand, see yourself as a kind of Ben Gazzara, tough, hard little guy from the Lower East Side, you know, playing it rough and cool and close to the belt? And when you play good guys, they're tough good guys. They're tough, hard, rough doctors. They're just sort of, you know, out of the corner of the mouth. Nobody's putting anything over on me, boy. And, sure, I'm here in the mail room. I know this gaff, though. Ain't putting nothing over on me. I picked it. It's the way I'm going to live. But then, on the other hand, perhaps you see yourself as a kindly feature player, a sort of Fay Bainter of existence, or maybe a Cuddles Sakal of life. Shoo, 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 that girl. She has talent there. Oh, yes. Do you see yourself as the Santa Claus of the Costa County Department? Eh, friends? Really? The Gene Lockhart of life? Or are you the Eugene Pallet of existence? All these people all fill definite spots in our life. Speaking of character actors, this is WOR AM at FM New York. Hit the money button, please, Mario, if you will.
Miller High Life in Poppin' Pour cans. Distinctive Miller High Life in Poppin' Pour cans. Just pop and pour Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer. No opener needed. And inside every can, enjoy the hearty yet light goodness of Miller High Life, brewed from a century-old recipe, only in Milwaukee. Miller High Life always gives you that perfect taste in beer every time. Always a bright, clear taste, unequaled, unquestioned, unchanging. Now you can enjoy refreshing Miller High Life in Pop and Pour cans. Pop and Pour Miller High Life. Always sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Now in Pop and Pour cans.
Very good. Very good. Do you have another one in there for us here? All right. Let us titillate the unwashed. Hit it there.
Feel like going to town? Fly Pan Am to London Town. Rent a room for just a few dollars a day. Pick up some theater tickets for a dollar apiece. Have fish and chips for 50 cents. Tour the town for the price of a bus ticket. Buy a custom-made suit for less than half the New York price. Have dinner in Soho for $2. See the Turners at the Tate for free. Ride the Underground for next to nothing. Play darts in a pub just for the fun of it. And take a stroll along the Thames. It's only hours away. Pan Am has non-stop jets to London at 10 every morning and 7 and 8 every evening. And you can take advantage of Pan Am's low 14 to 21 day jet excursion fares to Europe. See a Pan Am travel agent or call 973-4000. For Pan Am, the world's most experienced airline.
All kinds of experiences, I tell you. Oh yes, we have here American Heritage, and if you don't know anything about the magazine, it's $3.95 per each copy. This is strictly for the high rent district. And if you'd like to get a copy for $1, send your name and address and a dollar to American Heritage, Box 711, Great Neck, New York. Don't send it to me. I'll just pocket it and go out and have fun. The address is American Heritage, Box 711, Great Neck. They will send you a representative copy. It's a funny thing. Speaking of showbiz, which, of course, just permeates the whole atmosphere that we live in, it's beginning to creep in so much now that it's just accepted as part of our life. It's accepted the way we accept advertising, the way we accept the spring and the birds and the sky and the sun and the sand. And it's just part of life. And do you remember the day when people used to complain because for example, fictional characters did not match the characters in real life. You remember people used to talk about, they used to say, oh, come on, real cowboys aren't like Gary Cooper. Remember when they used to say that? People used to complain that that a doctor that you see on television or a doctor that you see in the movies isn't the way real doctors are. They used to complain about that. Well, now it's quite the opposite now. Are you aware that there's a great growing trend among the various professions now to pattern themselves after their fictional counterparts? In other words, instead of the AMA getting mad at Ben Casey, the AMA is recommending its various members to take the Ben Casey course. Now, I'm not making this up. I'm really not. You know that recently, out in the Midwest, there was a graduation of nurses. Now, these are real nurses. And so, who do you think they have to come to address the graduating class of nurses? A famous nurse? No. An actress who plays nurses. She's never been a nurse in her life. And in fact, she knows more about William Morris than she knows about Bellevue, of course. In fact, she's been in William Morris a lot more than Bellevue. Nevertheless, they're all flattered to have this fictional nurse come and address them. And somehow it made all the young nurses feel that they were looking at the big time. They were looking at a real nurse, you know, instead of old Miss Grumbage over there on the fifth floor, that old terrible person in the GY ward, you know. They want to get the real one. Now I have here, it's beginning to sneak into all professions. I have a trade journal from the pharmacy world. It's called Drug Topics. And they had a big pharmacist seminar at Rutgers recently in Lakewood. And the headline reads, Pharmacy Men, RX Men Urge to Become Dr. Kildares. And the whole idea of one of the big seminars was that the, you know, instead of being just what they are, you know, pharmacists walking around there and giving you bennies if you, you know, if you come in and you give them the prescription, and you know how they are, you know, they're just guys. They walk around, they sell combs, and they'll sell your cough drops, or if not, they'll, you know, they'll sell you cigarettes. You know, you've been in drugstores. They say that this is not good. Being what they are is not good. It's a bad image. And so now they're going to all work on becoming Kildares. Well, now, what Kildare has to do with mixing prescriptions, I have no idea. And I've never known a doctor in all my born days that acted anything like Dr. Kildare does. Believe me, if I had a doctor like Ben Casey, I'd hit him in the mouth. After about the third yipe from that guy, I'd belt him one right in the kisser, you know. Have you noticed that all doctors are on TV are constantly yelling at their patients? Now, they're not yelling at them to take the medicine, I mean, which is totally within a doctor's province, but they're yelling at them about the way they live their lives, about whether they love Charlie or not. They're yelling at them about whether or not they should have the second kid. They're yelling at them about all kinds of peripheral things. And how many of you know that Johnny Berardino, who is a doctor in, isn't that show called General Hospital? I wonder how many of you know that he played on one of the worst baseball teams in the history of the major leagues. And now he's playing very testy doctors. I suspect he plays the doctor about the way he played second base. He was a second baseman. And do you know, I'll give you a brass figure if you can tell me the name of the team he played with. Have you noticed how many ball players are becoming actors? Which leads me to believe they never were ball players in the first place. You know, they wore the glove well, and they could wear the hat well. And Chuck Connors was a terrible first baseman, for those of you who think he was great. He was awful. He was an early Marv Thornberry, in case you're interested. And I don't know why Marv doesn't get himself a TV series. No, I think he'd be great on a TV series. But I've wondered about the connection between ball players and acting, because most ball players I've known, and I've known many of them, most ball players I know speak in monosyllables. And usually they're one-syllable words that are spelled with four letters. Ball players are not quite Laurence Olivier. There's not much Gielgud, believe me, in Whitey Ford's makeup. And yet, somehow, there is a definite connection. Have you noticed, curiously enough, that casting directors and people will accept a ball player as being a talented actor, but and even the critics do. strangely enough. And yet they get furious when, say, somebody who is a singer acts. They never accept a singer as an actor. It's taken them 15 years now to accept Sinatra, even remote. He's still a singer as far as most of the critics are concerned. And yet, to me, Chuck Connors, is it O'Connor? Chuck Connors is far more a first baseman than he ever is an actor. I've seen him act. Of course, I saw him play first base, too, so, you know, like, that puts me in a disadvantage there, because I saw him one time get hit in the mouth. He came in fast on a ground ball, and the ground ball the ground ball went left, and he went right, and the two met in right there on the baseline, and he went down for it, and the ball came up. And Chuck Connors, I think, at that moment decided he better go down and see his agent, see if he could get a TV series. This was getting a little rough. but there is a connection there, and I wonder why it is. Why it is, because if there's anything that is remote from acting, it is the athletic world. Because you really can't talk yourself to first base. You can't act it out at home plate. You either steal second or you don't. It's a very real world, and yet somehow they have been making it very... do you know what show he plays in, Berardino? He plays a doctor, of all things, yeah. And every time I see him, I keep thinking of that terrible ball club. Holy smokes, what a ball club. You know, it's funny how we think the Mets are bad. That's purely a myth. The Mets are not a good team, but they're not nearly as bad a team. There's been plenty of worse teams around than the Mets, and I don't want to do a baseball show here tonight, but... that's part of the showbiz image of the Mets, that they're such a fantastically inept team, and somehow it's all connected with pop art, you know, that whole bit, that anybody can play second base as good as the Mets second baseman. So you feel involved with them. Anybody can pitch as good as Roger Craig, you see. So you feel involved with them, just the way you feel involved with Andy Warhol stuff, which you could do. Anybody can do it. You just got to have guts and a good agent, and you can. The myth of the Mets being the worst ball team is one of the funniest myths of our time. This can only come from people who either have very short memories or know very little about baseball. To begin with, they're playing in the toughest league that's been around in a long time. I don't recall in a long time a league being as uniformly tough as the National League has been the last 5 or 6 years. There's 4 or 5 really good pennant-contending teams in that league. This is a tough league, one of the toughest leagues it's been in a long time, and the Mets are in it, you know, they're up there, where they're playing in that league. Now, on the other hand, I can remember ball clubs in the American League, for example, where, I mean, they were playing in a bad league, and to be last place in a bad league is not easy to do. I mean, a league where there were 4 last place teams. I remember when there would be 4 teams fighting for last place. I mean, really, literally, in the American League. And there were only 2 or 3 good teams in the whole league, and 45 games out of first would be the St. Louis Browns. And I mean 45 games out of first the second week of the season. And that was the ball club that Johnny Berardino played on. What a great club. And they had uniforms, special uniforms that the Browns had, that were they were designed to look like they were fading into the background. They had peculiar kind of uniforms. I will award the brass figlegief to anybody out there who can tell me what the Browns' insignia consisted of, what they wore as an insignia. Yeah. Well, how about the Braves when they were in Boston? What were they called? In fact, they got so desperate, the Braves were so terrible when they were in Boston, that they even decided, well, we better start all over again. Let's just change the name. It would be as if the Yankees decided, it would be as if the Mets got so bad that they decided to call themselves the Charlie Browns or the 3rd Street AC. They thought if they changed their name, do you remember when they changed the name of the Braves? What did they change it to? And what was the insignia they wore on their uniform from that minute on? And nobody ever called them that, but they persisted in wearing this on their uniform. For the last couple of years they were there, they finally forgot that whole schlemoo, went back out to Milwaukee and became the Braves again. I don't know why we're doing a baseball show tonight, but you know, this whole thing of showbiz has fascinated me, particularly in relationship to sports. Have you noticed how many sports guys are getting into showbiz and how sports is becoming showbiz? It used to be a separate side of man's life, and now you read certain magazines, for example. There are certain sporting magazines, which read more like showbiz magazines than they do sporting. For example, I believe Sports Illustrated reads far more like a showbiz magazine than it does a magazine about sports. Their whole attitude is showbiz. It's exciting, it's color, and they're talking about this profile or that personality, and it's all written with the same tone that they used to write Theater Arts magazine. You remember Theater Arts magazine? It was written pretty much in the same tone, the same tenor. Very arty, artsy, craftsy, really, is the word, and has very little to do with the sweat and the yelling and the anger and the what baseball or whatever the sport happens to be, whatever it's really about. These guys that show up on Sunday afternoon television, I think, are an example of the new showbiz. How many ski meets do they have a week? What is this? And it's always the same guys, constantly. Yeah, who said Elf? Elf. You pulled your thing up, read your own writing. It says Elf there. No, it's the Boston Bees. And they had a bee, a little bee on their cap. It was so sad, you know. they came out with their jazzy little uniforms, and they had little yellow bees, and they had little wings on them. And the poor old Boston Bees were still first in the hearts of their countrymen, but last in the National League. They were way down at the bottom. They were far worse, really, in their worst days than the Mets ever were. You know, because one thing about the Mets, this has to be stated, obviously, the Mets are colorful. You people here in New York do not know what it's like to have a bad, uncolorful ball club. I mean a ball club that's so dull you can't even tell the players with the numbers and with the scorecard. And it doesn't make any difference if you do tell them. They're all 122 hitters, you know, all the way down the line. And there's nobody who misses a ball colorfully. They just sort of miss it. You know, it's not like old Marv. You kind of loved Marv when Marv swallowed a ground ball. You know, you loved him. But you never could get so that you loved Boz Berger, who played third base for the Chicago White Sox. And Boz Berger always looked apologetic out there. He'd come out there and he'd sort of hide behind the bag. You know, and you always felt that he felt embarrassed when the Yankees were playing against him. It was like he was masquerading. You know, you had to, pow, there'd be this ground ball go down past him, and Boz would dive and kick up a lot of dirt, but he'd dive in the wrong direction. The ball would be on his right side, he'd dive to his left, you know, that kind of thing. And nobody really loved, but yet they didn't hate him. They just sort of accepted him. You know, you kind of get involved in that low ground. And, you know, speaking of showbiz, funny thing, the other night, I happened to, it was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I had the TV and switching across channels, and they had this science fiction movie. And it was a science fiction movie about the center of the Earth. It's not done very often. You know, most of the time we think of science fiction always going out to Saturn or Mars. And it was the center of the Earth bit, you know. And I wonder how many people look at the Earth that we live in as kind of a stage. It's a platform upon which you perform the things that you perform. I think one of the things that sets man apart from all the other animals is his self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is what causes show business to come about. I don't think a lion, for example, stalking a zebra is aware of its style, is aware that it's doing something in style. It says, watch this now. Watch how I put my paws down. Watch how my ears cock. Now watch this. Now watch how I get underway. Now watch. You know, watch this. No. I don't think any other animal does this. A lot of people will try to make you believe that a horse at the horse show knows that he's on, that he's enjoying the applause, that somehow he knows that he's supposed to do this, and because he's doing it, he's in showbiz. I'm sure a lot of people looking at Kelso think of Kelso as a star, and Kelso knows he's a star. That when Kelso comes back to the barn, he knows he's more important than that nag down there. There's an old exercise nag, you know, 3 or 4 stalls down. Does Kelso know that Kelso is a thoroughbred? And is there such a thing as a thoroughbred among horses? Really? Does a dog know that he or she is a thoroughbred? Does a dog know this? Well, people who have them seem to think they do. And I think that's all part of the showbiz area. And I'm watching this late-night TV show, and it's about the Earth. And you know, by George, looking at this, I began to realize that they were treating the Earth as a kind of prop. Not only a prop, it's a kind of backdrop, a set. The center of the Earth is a set for what these guys are doing. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute, fellas, you know, hey, that's the Earth you're talking about. And I realized that hardly anybody ever talks about what's down there, down inside. And I ran across a piece. You got something? Give me my sinister music there for all of you who are Earth fans. Hold it there for a minute. I'm a great Earth fan because as a kid, I used to dig caves. I was a great cave digger, and I think this is a male thing. I do not think girls ever dig caves. If they do, they do it merely because the boys are doing it. But practically every boy I've ever known has at one time or another been driven to dig a cave. Dig a hole, literally, in the ground. Have you done that? You know, dig the cave. Cover it over. Put burlap over it and dirt and turf over the top of it. Dig deeper and deeper and deeper. Men are fascinated by the center of the Earth. And if you want to hear something scary, if you think you know all about it, there was a piece came out just a couple of days ago. In fact, it came out just after the first of the year. There is something sneaky in the Earth. Sneaky. Something down there. Listen to this. Bring it up. Montreal. Beneath the remote outpost of Alert at the northernmost tip of Canada, Ellesmere Island, something big, unusual, and mysterious appears to be concealed deep within the earth. Did you hear that? Isn't it amazing how the really gigantic news items are not even, they're way in the back somewhere. Some feature writer will write it. And up in the front, we're having a big schlemoo about this school strike and about this boycott. The little trivial things you won't remember for 2 days. And way in the back, listen to that. I'll read this again in case you missed it. Beneath the earth, this is the remote outpost of Alert at the northernmost tip of Canada. Something big, unusual, and mysterious appears to be concealed deep within the Earth. If it is real, said the Canadian Earth scientist who is working on the case, he's begun to piece together a model of this thing. And it looks like this. It has the shape of a loaf of home-baked bread, nearly cylindrical. It's about 65 miles long and 65 miles thick. It lies on a line that extends southwest from Alert. It begins about 15 miles beneath the icy surface of that part of the world. Now, it's 15 miles deep. And it reaches a depth of almost 80 miles. And it appears to straddle the boundary between the Earth's crust and the next layer beneath, which they call the mantle. Now, the material composition of this thing is entirely a mystery. They do not know what it is. Automatically, you say, oh, it's a big rock. Don't be so quick. They say no. Professor John M. DeLaurier of the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa says it is a mystery. He was describing it to the geology session of the American Association of the Advancement of Science. Near Alert, the United States and Canada jointly operate a weather station with equipment to detect earth tremors and to measure fluctuations in the Earth's magnetic field. It was from tracing peculiar, mysterious irregularities in the Earth's magnetic field in that region that something unusual began to appear, said DeLaurier. Now, I remember seeing, several years back, a science fiction movie about that part of the Earth. Do you remember it? It was about the Arctic. Now, what they had eventually, of course, it was ridiculous the way it finally worked out. But there's a strange parallel because they began to detect unusual things in the magnetic field of the Earth up there. These guys were in a weather station, and they had this Earth magnetic field equipment. And they were detecting strange things. And there was something buried in the ice. Do you remember that? It was buried down in the ice, and they knew it was something fantastic and big. Well, that's exactly what's happening up there. And nobody's saying a word about it. Well, listen to this. DeLaurier, this is the scientist, DeLaurier, said that there is an unusually large distortion in the magnetic field in the alert region. There's a distortion of the field. Something is happening there. It's not rock, obviously. Also, and here's interesting stuff, the Earth's magnetic field apparently induces a strong flow of electricity in this formation. In other words, whatever that thing is, electricity is induced in it. And he said, just like electricity running through a metallic wire, this conductor, whatever it is in the Earth, is surrounded by a special magnetic field of its own. Now, there's a curious story. I read this, and I thought, gee, nobody's remarked. However, in rocks of the kind that might be suspected, now, if you immediately say, oh, well, I can explain that geologically. Listen, in rocks of the kind that might be suspected at such depths in the Earth, such a high electrical conductivity would mean that they were at a temperature of more than 2,700 degrees. And he goes on to say it would be most unusual to find so large a body of molten rock in that region of northern Canada. He says it's a complete mystery. They do not know what this thing is lying below the field. He goes on to say he declined to speculate on what might account for all these unusual circumstances. He said, but he hopes to study the region more intensively in the future. Right now, in the darkness, just north of us, lies a strange, mysterious foreign body under the surface of the Earth, 65 miles long and 65 miles wide, 15 miles deep at one end. It kind of tilts down, and 80 miles deep at the other, with a strange, mysterious magnetic field around it. Well, now, how do you like that? Any theories? Anything to say about it, gang? Any comments? And that's all they said. I haven't read a follow-up on that. Obviously, somebody's up there studying this thing, and it's up there in the north. It's up there in the in that frozen north. Of course, I must admit that I'm a sucker for anything that has anything to do with the north. I'm a real sucker for the north. I love the north. In fact, whenever I get a chance to go on a vacation, I usually go up to Maine or up in the Canadian woods. I love the north. Why? I don't know. There's a peculiar quality to it that, to me, is far more exciting than to go down to the south or the Caribbean. There's a certain wildness, a certain sneaky mysteriousness. And I wonder how many of you as kids were influenced the way I was influenced by somebody reading a story to you, or you reading a story about the frozen north. I don't think kids read about the frozen north much anymore, do they? Maybe they do, I don't know. Do kids in school today read Jack London ever? Do they ever read him? Who was a fascinating American storyteller, a great storyteller, as a matter of fact. And I remember reading this story. I'm a kid, you know, and how, I don't know, how or why we were assigned it, I don't recall, but I'm reading a story about this scene in Jack London, a man and a dog. Do you remember that scene? They were on the trail, and the upshot of it was that the man froze to death. Do you remember that story? Reading the story of this man freezing to death and the dog waiting there and plodding along behind him. And I remember reading this thing, and I read, wow, boy, I mean, out of my skull, you know, further. And then at the end, when he died, I couldn't believe it. You know, here he really died. Do you remember a Jack London story? He wrote a series of stories, strange stories about the South Pacific. I remember one story about the man standing. All I remember is the scene. Some real tough, wild, cruel type cat with red hair standing at the rear of a boat, a dugout canoe, and he's being rapidly rowed back to his ship, and he's the captain of this ship. And apparently they were on some kind of a slave gathering expedition out there, and he's standing on the back, and these Kanakas, these Indians, the natives there, the Polynesians, are rowing frantically after him. They're wildly after him, and he is lighting with his cigar. He is lighting sticks of dynamite, and just throwing them like firecrackers at the natives. He just boom. Do you remember that scene? And how they got him later on? Many, many years later, he was on the beach there, and they found him all cut to tiny little pieces. Boy, this was wild stuff for a kid to read. But I wonder how many guys were influenced as kids by reading Jack London and stories of the frozen north, and still have that feeling when you say there are certain words by their nature that are exciting, and I'll give you one of them: tundra. That is an exciting word, tundra. Just the word tundra. Here's another word too that's exciting: glacier. It's an exciting word. Why? I don't know. It just, you know, wow, tundra. Wouldn't you like muskeg? Isn't that an exciting word? Husky. That's another exciting word. Caribou. Those are pemmican. Those are exciting words. And these are words which you don't hear very often. And maybe that's what makes them exciting. I remember flying in a plane. We'd come the Great Circle Route, and I'd come in over Greenland, and the plane was flying in over way far northern. We were way over northern Canada and coming down the coast. And one of the pilots, he was the co-pilot, came back, and he was sitting on the edge of the seat there. I was talking to him, and I'm looking down to that gray sky, and you can see a few frozen lakes way down below. And I said, "What is that? What is that?" And he said, "Oh, that's tundra down there." I said, "Tundra? Holy smokes." And sure enough, I could see it spread out for miles and miles. And it was dead winter. It was February when I was flying over that. So you can imagine what the temperature must have been down there on the ground. He says, "Oh, that's tundra." And I could see those frozen lakes spotted. And somewhere off in that frozen north, there must have been a herd or two of caribou. Do they pronounce it caribou or caribou? Muskeg, tundra, the glaciers, the Arctic Circle, the Northern Lights. These are things you cannot deny have a sneaky, secret lure. And here we are, sitting quietly in the middle of New York City, surrounded by Mary Martin, Richard Rogers, all the channels. Channel Whoopi is on the air, and way off up in that frozen north, a million, million miles from here, is a mysterious thing in the ground. 65 miles long and 65 miles deep, with a pattern of magnetic force around it. Flux is the word. Would you like to just get in the convertible and drive north now? You know, pack your little American Airlines bag and. wouldn't you love to do some mushing tonight? You know. With those snowshoes, to me, snowshoes have always been 5,000 times more exciting than skis. Keep your knees loose, Fred, and button up your coat. You never know.